It wasn't quite the grand gesture entrance Etiard had hoped for. Even though he'd slipped through the ground-level walls with no problem, he still had 10 flights of those ever-damned Macathron-style stairs to climb, and he was in a hurry, fearful that every second of delay would act against him. When he finally passed through the wall into Christabel's bedroom, he was nearly breathless from all the exertion. Christabel was still on the bed, sitting at one end, shoulders slumped, head in her hands, with her thick mane of hair hanging down over her knees. The broad glass doors to the Hortus were open. Manartha was outside, bending over the vine-clad wall to look down on the western districts. Etiard abandoned his concealment and closed the glass doors. Manartha spun round, her little mouth open in shock. Her fright vanished when she saw it was Etiard who'd materialized in the room, replaced with immediate indignation. Her hands jabbed into her sides as she glared at him in affront. "It's all right," Christabel told her with a croaky voice and unsteady long talk. "Walk round the Hortus, for me, please." Manartha gave Etiard a final glare, then stomped off. Etiard went down on his knees in front of Christabel and laced his fingers together as if in prayer. "I am so sorry," he said. "Please marry me. I didn't know before." Christabel combed some of her hair away from her face. Her eyes were red and puffy, while by contrast her cheeks had paled as if she was ill. "Marry you? Please?" Confusion clouded her gaze. "You didn't know?" "This week and a day thing. I had no idea, I swear. Please believe me. I would never try to deceive you in any way, let alone this. I love you, Christabel." "You didn't know?" Her voice had risen in hope. "No, by all the lady holds precious, I did not know." Her tears began to flow again, but now her mouth had lifted in a smile. "You didn't know?" It was nearly a wail. Etiard bowed his head in suffering. "Gache fungi," he pleaded. Christabel started to laugh. It swiftly turned to sobbing. She swatted his head, then somehow they were clutching desperately at each other. "I thought," she wept, "I thought you'd... I don't know what I thought. I didn't understand. After that week, everything we did, everything we shared, I didn't know why." "Shush," he urged her, and held her tighter. "Shush. It was a stupid mistake and all my fault, and I will spend the rest of my life making it up to you. I promise. Now I'm going to go to your father right this second and ask his permission. I know I've only got a day. That's..." He paused, gulped. "If you'll have me." "No," she said. "What?" he demanded, stricken. "Yes," she said quickly. "Sorry, yes, of course I want to marry you. Look at the state I'm in at the thought of not. But no, I don't want you to go to father." "Why?" "Because this is guilt talking." "No, it's not. I want to marry you. I can't believe you actually want me, but if you think I'm going to be stupid again, then I..." "Listen," she said, and grasped his hands, forcing them to be still. "Look at me." Etiard did as he was told. Even with tears all over her face, she was bewitchingly beautiful. "When I asked you to spend the week with me, I knew what I was asking," she said. "I gave you what I thought was a choice. The traditional a week and the day, or just become lovers that night there and then with no obligation. You went for the week, which in itself tells me a lot about you, that you'd respect me rather than settle for a quick tumble. But you didn't know what that was supposed to be, what it meant. You weren't thinking of marriage. And that applies now as much as it did then. You haven't thought this through. Believe me, I have, and I know what I want. But Etiard, you've known for about... how long?"
"Cancine just explained to me," he admitted.
"An hour, then?" "No, not that long. I came straight away, I promise." "All right, half an hour. Etiard, you don't make a decision like this in half an hour. You're doing it because of a huge misunderstanding, and you very gallantly don't want to upset me, which only makes you more adorable. But it still doesn't make this the right thing for you. That's all wrong. I want to marry you, I do." "Fine.
Did Cansine explain why we have this custom?
To see if we're okay physically. He cleared his throat self-consciously. I think we passed that test, didn't we?
We did. Very much so. But did she say why we needed to find that out first?
Because if we marry, we'll spend a long time together, centuries, probably. Everything has to be right.
Yes, and even that's no guarantee, especially if we marry as young as we are. 100 years is a long time to sustain love, let alone 200. So, do you see now? I thought about this from the moment we met, and I knew it was the right thing to do for me to ask you. But you hadn't thought about it. You still haven't, except for this wild impulse. Edyard, I need you to think clearly what you're asking. I need that from you, please.
Oh. He sat back on his ankles.
Of course, he said formally.
She grinned and peered closely at him.
And that doesn't mean you spend a week trying to work out how long you have to wait to make it seem like you've considered everything properly.
Understand?
Yes.
Edyard could actually feel the warmth of the blush rise up his cheeks.
Lady, what is life going to be like with you?
She smiled back and kissed his nose.
As difficult as I can make it.
That's fair. He held her head so he could kiss her properly. They spent a long time in a soft embrace before finally moving apart. Edyard's farsight revealed a highly agitated Lorin urging Homelt and 4 armed guards up the 3rd flight of stairs. Fit though they all were, it was hard going.
Your uncle's on his way, Edyard murmured. And Manatha is back, she said spryly.
Edyard turned around to see the little girl pressed against the glass, peering through. Then his farsight caught Julin approaching down the central corridor.
Oh, lady, he groaned. I'll deal with Daddy, she said, and directed her long talk to him.
Edyard allowed the glass doors to open again.
Are you sorry? Manatha asked.
Very sorry, Edyard assured her. Your sister and I have made up now.
I knew you would.
I wish I'd known.
She tilted her head up to scrutinize him. As he squirmed under the gaze, Edyard finally understood the phrase, 6 going on 60.
If I was older, I'd have you for my husband, Manatha decided.
That's good.
Christabel kissed her sister on the top of her head. Once more round the Hortus.
Chrissy!
Go, now.
Manatha gave her a sullen glare and pranced out.
Christabel smiled after her. I already feel sorry for her husband.
Your father?
Edyard queried.
Placated for the moment. We're both going to have to talk to him.
Edyard tried to smile supportively.
He'll understand, more than anyone.
She went over to study herself in a full-length mirror.
Oh, my sweet lady, look at me.
You look fabulous.
That's very loyal, if not very realistic.
Christabel directed a long talk summons to her maid.
I'm going to get ready to face people again. I will be some time.
She started teasing strands of her hair out of the tangle.
Okay.
Now he started looking round the bedroom properly. He saw that what Manatha was to pink, so Christabel was to frilly lace trimmings. It was slightly unnerving.
You can wait if you like, she said.
I would, yes.
Edyard? Not in here?
Ah, right.
Christabel found a set of clips on a dresser.
And Edyard?
Yes.
What exactly did happen to poor Uncle Lorin down there in the courtyard?
I've no idea, he said innocently, and hurriedly closed the door behind him.
Captain LaRose was waiting outside the Jeevan station entrance. Just seeing him in his ceremonial blue and scarlet jacket, with his sword and pistol hanging from his white leather belt, his back held perfectly straight, took Edyard back to the day he'd first encountered a militia officer on the road to Macathran. LaRose had the same aristocratic arrogance as that patrol officer as well. 5 ordinary soldiers accompanied him.
Water, Walker, LaRose said as Edyard approached.
Captain,
Mayor Owen requests that you attend him.
Edyard didn't know what to make of that at all.
I see,
Excellent. LaRose turned to his soldiers. Fall in, chaps.
Why the escort? Edyard said.
Captain LaRose smiled thinly. The mayor does rather enjoy the trappings of office. He says it helps remind people of the order of things.
Oh.
Personally, I find all this pomp and ceremony a real pain in the ass. My mess staff spend half the night getting my uniforms ready.
Edyard resisted the impulse to look down and check his own tunic. Apart from the new one Christabel had got for him, he was still wearing the ones he'd bought during his probationary period. They were starting to show signs of wear and tear.
Where are we going? Edyard asked as they started to walk along Chate Street towards the Brotherhood Canal. He'd assumed they'd be going to the Orchard Palace.
The militia stables, LaRose said. The Furlus and Zelda regiment is leaving for Talents province today, and it's customary for the mayor to see the troops off.
I didn't know that.
It's happening a lot now. I'm probably going to get deployment orders myself soon.
He gave Edyard a rueful grin. Not exactly what I signed up for, but one has a duty, yes?
Yes, Edyard agreed promptly.
Good man. You've been quite an inspiration to people lately. It's about time someone brought the gangs to heel. Things simply cannot go on as they are.
Edyard was mildly surprised. He'd assumed the captain wouldn't really approve of him. He'd met so many arrogant, useless family sons that these days he simply classed them all together as beneath contempt. But for all his airs, at least LaRose seemed to have some awareness of what was going on in the world. The wooden stables in the middle of Tycho's wide meadowland were bustling with activity. At one end, the regiment themselves were mounting up and forming ranks. 200 officers and soldiers on horseback, dressed in their full uniforms and regalia. Edyard had to admit it was a rousing sight. The purple and green insignia of the regiment was prominent, never more so than on the elaborately feathered headgear of the colonel, who sat astride his midnight black terrestrial horse, with two groomed G-wolves keeping flank. Down at the other end of the stables, Edyard's farsight observed the mess staff and G-monkeys getting ready in an altogether less structured manner. Nearly 40 wagons were loaded with supplies, with the final bales and boxes being hurriedly piled on board under the cursing of the quartermaster and his aides. Two smaller covered wagons contained arms and munitions, each guarded by 5 soldiers and their own pack of G-wolves. A small flock of livestock were being herded by G-dogs, while chickens and geese squawked from inside their cages. It looked like a much more difficult operation than getting the soldiers ready. Mayor Owen was standing on a wooden platform at the end of the stables, surrounded by a gaggle of advisers and 3 other masters. He wore his maroon and sapphire robes with a startlingly white fur trim, the hood loose over his shoulder. As always, Owen's mind was perfectly shielded, while his facial expression radiated interest in the vista before him.
Not long, LaRose muttered to Edyard as they waited at the foot of the stairs of the platform.
The regimental bugler sounded formation, and the horses quickly arranged themselves in front of the mayor's platform. 10 G-eagles settled on the stable roofs. The colonel saluted from his saddle.
I wish you good fortune on your endeavor, Mayor Owen said to the assembled regiment. I am confident you will restore order to Talents province. Whilst bandits may find it easy to elude local farmers and sheriffs, they will soon discover it is altogether different to run and hide from a stalwart man of the regiment riding after them. It is with pride that I see you leave today, knowing that our city is the symbol of hope that all on Querentia turn to in their moment of deepest need. I know that above all, the militia can be relied on to complete their task with honor.
The colonel led his hearty 3 cheers for the mayor, who applauded them back. Then the bugler sounded slow advance, and the regiment began its ride to the city gate, and its undertaking beyond. Their G-eagles took flight, soaring out towards the crystal wall. Owen stood on the platform, his face perfectly composed until the last man rode past. It was only when the first of the wagons began to roll out that he turned and made his way down the steps.
Your Honor, Edyard said courteously as the mayor reached the ground.
Water Walker, thank you for coming. I hope it's not too inconvenient.
No, sir.
Owen actually smiled.
Ah,
polite as well as effective. How long before you're our chief constable, eh?
I don't think Walsfole has anything to worry about, Your Honour.
We shall see. Walk with me, please.
He waved a hand at the gaggle of advisers who fell back discreetly. Captain LaRose and the soldiers took up position just behind them. Owen chose a narrow track which led back towards the outer circle canal around Majate. The meadowland on either side was just about deserted.
I regret that we seem to have started off on the wrong foot, young water walker. I blame myself. You are Finnetan's protege, after all.
He supports banishment, Your Honour.
Yes, so do I.
I didn't know that, Your Honour.
Still polite, even in the face of provocation. You are too kind, water walker. You see me as someone who has opposed your clever exclusion warrants, and who, of course, will fight Finnetan and his proposal.
It does seem that way, Your Honour, yes.
I'm sure it does. That is because you are young and, your pardon, can as yet only visualize short-term benefits. Do you really think, do you believe in your own heart, that I do not want this city rid of crime?
No.
Precisely. Well, I thank you for that courtesy. I actually rather liked the idea of the exclusion warrants. You are to be congratulated on implementing them, and against such strong political opposition.
Given what I understand of this city's politics, a policy which you opposed would always gain support from other quarters.
Owen grinned smoothly. Which brings us to today. What did you think of the regiment?
Edyard glanced back towards the stables. The last of the wagons had now left the wooden buildings. Animals bleated as they were herded along behind. I think the bandits will be in a lot of trouble. The Jeevan's station's G-Eagle was spiraling lazily above City Gate, showing Edyard five new wagons belonging to the Weapons Guild. They were parked to one side of the road, waiting. He knew they would follow the regiment all the way to Talent's province, where they would sell pistols to the frightened farmers and villagers, profiting Owen's guild still further, just as Jessile said. It wasn't a crime, he acknowledged, but that didn't make it right either.
Yes, Owen said, but why are they there in the first place?
They are everywhere.
Indeed they are. The bandits and the gangs are symptomatic of our society's failings, Water Walker. That is what I am truly opposed to.
I'm not sure I understand, Your Honour.
If you banish the gang leadership from the city, where will they go?
Beyond the borders of the furthest province or some distant island. That's what I had in mind.
Of course, it would seem humane. I'd expect nothing less from a man of principle like you. We're all guilty of listening to the city's tittle-tattle about you, Water Walker, but not once have I heard it said you lack integrity, and for that I thank the lady. But have you considered what will occur a year, or even 10, after they begin their banishment? The resentment? The lure of returning? If they didn't come back here, they would surely join with the bandits.
So what is your proposal? I assume that's what we are discussing.
We are. My proposal, as you put it, is that we do not treat the gangs and the bandits in isolation. We all live on one world. We must become one nation. Our problems must be dealt with in unison. The militia regiments out in the countryside, the constables here in the city. When we have rounded up all of the miscreants, then we can exile them in perpetuity. I like your idea of a remote island. That would certainly make them containable.
So what's the difference between you and Finnetan?
Finnetan thinks only of the city, of short-term solutions. Don't tell me you haven't worried about what happens to people after banishment.
I've considered it, Your Honour, Edyard admitted. We seem to be making things worse on the Uguru, what with all the highwaymen. That's why I wanted banishment.
But you do see we can't treat these problems in isolation.
I understand both problems have to be confronted, yes.
I am happy to hear that. Unfortunately, the easy one is the city. You have shown us how it can be achieved, Water Walker. Nobody doubts you will ultimately succeed. Not even poor old Boate.
I'd settle for Bice capitulating.
Owen laughed.
Don't worry. When the time comes, I will stand over Master Bice personally and ensure he signs the exclusion warrants for Sampaloc.
Your Honour?
It is simple politics. Master Bice believes he can gain more influence by supporting me. In council, it pays me to encourage such support. Ultimately, Bice will accept the inevitable and his nefarious allies will be purged from our streets. That's a relief to know. I thought it would be. So, whilst not asking you to switch your support, for Finnatan is your patron, and I would not want to foster such disloyalty, do you at least agree with some of my objectives?
Yes, Your Honor, I do.
Thank you. Why can you not reach a concord with Master Finnatan? Sadly, we have been adversaries for too long. Neither of us trusts the other. And I have to say, I will campaign long and hard to retain my office, no matter what we agree or disagree in private. Such is the nature of humanity. Least of all, flawed specimens like us, ancient conservative masters. Do you think it likely that Finnatan will back down?
No.
Precisely. I wanted to reassure you of my own goals, because whoever wins this election, it is you who will be fighting the gangs on the streets.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I admit, knowing you will be working for the city is of considerable relief to me. The constables have performed little short of a miracle since the day you walked on water, and that resounding victory over dear little Menatha's captors was extraordinary. I admit to joining the cheers of joy along Grand Major Canal that day. I ask the lady that she will be equally generous granting the militia victory. Theirs will be the more difficult task, and the one bogged down in politics.
How is that? Ediard asked.
They'd nearly reached the Outer Circle Canal. Up ahead he could see the bronze and jade bridge, which Ra himself had commissioned.
The countryside wishes to enjoy the benefits of the city without having to pay the cost, Owen said.
5 times since last summer I have dispatched our regiments to aid desperate provincial governors.
And what payments have we received?
A grudgingly given reimbursement for our basic costs. To what avail? The regiments ultimately have to come home, leaving the lands open once again to infiltration by the bandits.
It is a nonsense, a gesture which achieves nothing in the long term.
If we are to achieve stability and an end to this dreadful felony, then the provinces will have to pay taxes to Macathran for organizing their defense. Militias will have to be stationed permanently and strategically across the countryside. Such achievements will require tremendous organization. One province cannot be favored above another.
All costs, and they will be considerable, must be borne equally. The rule of law available to all without prejudice. Both the master in his mansion and the farmer in his cottage will have to answer to the same authority.
One nation, Ediard said.
Precisely.
At the moment, city and provinces are naught but a loose affiliate. And look where it has taken us, to the verge of anarchy. To face this new threat, we have to consolidate the forces of civilization, to strengthen our boundary and enforce our justice. Only as a nation where equality reigns can this happen.
They walked over the bridge together. Ediard's mind was a whirl, trying to take in all the mayor had said. Standing in the shade thrown by the sprawling conglomeration of Parliament House's buildings, Owen faced Ediard.
I hope you no longer consider me an enemy, Water Walker.
I never really did, Your Honor.
That gladdens me. Maybe one day, when your generation has risen to high office, you will extinguish the vanity and foolishness of petty politics that so bedevils us today. I wish you luck in that.
He inclined his head and walked into the tower housing the Guild of Clerks. His entourage went with him. Captain LaRose smiled knowingly as he passed Ediard.
Oh, lady, Ediard exhaled.
He turned and made his way slowly round the base of Parliament House, towards the bridge which would take him back into Jeevan's. So whoever wins, they'll support me against the gangs.
Despite everything the mayor had said, he still hoped it would be Finnatan, though the idea of a penal colony on a remote island was an intriguing one.
Of all the people in Macathran, Nanit was the one Ediard would never have expected to see waiting for him in the street outside the tenement. But there she was, when he made his way home that evening.
"Can I talk to you?" she asked as he reached the tenement's entrance.
Ediard's firesight swept round. He wasn't just searching for people he knew. This wouldn't look good to Maxen, for a start, but to see who Boate had got watching.
"You've got 1 minute," he said, after confirming there was nothing immediately suspicious.
"Not out here. This is too important."
Nanit's voice was brittle,
Her old self-confidence had gone. Etiard took a good look. Beneath her dark blue cloak, she wore a low-cut green and white dress, with her hair arranged in long waves. Now, out here in the sunlight, he could see the heavy makeup on her face. Even that didn't completely cover up the bruise. Her lip had recently been split as well.
All right, Etiard said reluctantly. 5 minutes.
Nanette looked round the inside of the maisonette with interest. Her hand slid over the cold alcove, fingers touching the milk jug and fruit.
It is all different in here, just like they said it was, she said as she walked over to the bed.
Her hand tested the firmness of the spongy substance.
Who said? Girls I've talked to. On Ivar's behalf, of course. They talk freely to me rather than him.
Etiard grunted. Right.
He was obsessed with you.
And his brother? Nanette slumped.
I hate him.
Etiard indicated her face. He hits you.
Among other things, yes.
Leave him.
She laughed bitterly. You said that with a straight face. You really do come from another place, don't you?
Probably.
I want to leave him, she said. Those things you said to him the other night. That's all going to happen, isn't it?
Yes, even if Owen gets elected. I was talking to him today.
So I'd be thrown out of the city?
That depends how deep your involvement is.
I was surprised I'm not on your warrants already.
We're concentrating on the violent ones for now.
It wouldn't be much of a life for me out there, not like that. Not the whore of an exile.
Why are you here, Nanette? What have you got to tell me?
He's going to buy guns. A lot of guns.
Who from?
She gave him a thin smile. If I left now, by myself, I thought perhaps I could go to one of the big towns beyond the Uguru Plain. Somewhere no one would know me or what I am. I could buy a small house or some land. If I had that, I could find a husband. A nice provincial man. I'd be able to make sure he loved me. Whores make the best wives, did you know that? I'm not quite sure I could do the whole house mistress and children thing for him. But we'd be happy, and all this, my life, would be gone.
I wish Boate thought like that.
No, you don't. You're enjoying this. It makes you live. You need to see him defeated. You want Macathran liberated from the gangs he controls. You need an ending, Water Walker. Throwing them out, just so's they can drift back into the city, over months and years, won't be good enough for you. The Water Walker requires finality. I don't know what you'll do to achieve it, but I know I don't want to be here when you do. Out of you and Boate, I think I'm actually more afraid of you.
That's a very nice summary of me. Shame it's not particularly accurate. Nanette glanced through the archway into the bathroom, her eyebrow rising at the sight of the perfectly flat steps leading down into the bathing pool.
It's not just mothers who can see the future, you know.
Why don't you just tell me what you know of the guns? I'll take you to the city gate myself. He'll never be able to stop you.
And how would I get my house and my land?
I thought, you must have money.
I was a dancer once, a long time ago. That's all I ever really wanted to be. Then one day Ivar visited the show I was in. That was it. He knew the theatre owner, of course, and I was young and stupid, stupid enough to believe his promises. After I'd been with him for a while, I realized that was it. I'd become a part of that life. There was no way back. No theatre owner would ever hire me unless he told them to. I gave up.
I'm sorry.
So there you are, Water Walker. I'm not just some girl working at the House of Blue Petals. I'm his. Do you know what it is to be owned like that? To be less than some Jennistar?
I won't patronize you by saying yes.
Thank you. So now you know. If you want me to tell you when and where he's getting the guns, you have to pay me. That's what all men do. They pay me for what I've got.
I'll have to ask my station captain, or maybe Finnerton.
She came to stand in front of him,
as self-assured as any master.
You don't have that much time. I need the money today. I want to be gone by morning.
There's a reason these things take time to arrange.
I told you of my dream, nothing more.
We both know I can survive anywhere. Is that what you want for me? To keep on doing what I do? I thought you were going to save us all, Water Walker.
I haven't got that kind of coinage.
Christabel does.
I can't ask her.
Why not? Actually, why aren't the two of you engaged? All of Macathran wants to know that. You can tell me. I'm leaving, remember?
Stop this. Nanit discarded her cloak as she went over to the bed and bent across it. Her hand slid over the sheets.
If you really want her, I can show you how to make your next week and the day work perfectly.
Get off the bed.
You know I'm good. Who do you think showed Ranelagh the physical side of her ability?
Edyard nearly reached out to grab her with his third hand, only just managing to keep his temper in check.
Nanit straightened up.
You see what I am, Water Walker? How low I am? They made me like this. And now I can't go back. Not after talking to you. You saw what happened to Ivar, and he wasn't even turning on them like I am. So now you have to ask yourself, how badly do you want them? Bad enough to ask Christabel for the kind of coinage she would spend on shoes to match one of her party dresses? Or are you just going to let this opportunity slip away, because it's all turned too personal for you?
This is not personal.
Good. Then I'll just wait here while you go and get my money.
We can't trust her, Maxon said the next morning when Edyard called them into the small hall.
Why not? Edyard asked, trying to be the reasonable one. He'd felt terrible going to Christabel for money. She, of course, had made light of it, saying how much she wanted to help. Her understanding didn't make him feel any better.
Nanit had counted the coins in the bag he brought back to the maisonette, unable to disguise her surprise by how much there was.
I should have done this a long time ago, she said.
Just tell me about the guns, he said. And she did, about the meeting in Boate's office, which she'd been excluded from, the men she'd never seen before, with accents that didn't come from any city district, how Boate had started talking about constable killer pistols and leveling up the score.
Because she's Nanit, Maxon said,
not understanding why that wasn't enough.
I could sense she was telling the truth about the guns, Edyard said.
I'd be more concerned about the rest of it, Boyd said. Your pardon, Edyard, but you don't have the greatest instinct when it comes to honesty. You always want to find the best in people.
Edyard gave his tall friend a surprised glance.
All right. So what could she have been lying about? The worst case is she made an ass of me and ran off with a lot of coinage. How does that put us in trouble at the exchange?
What was that phrase you used? Dinlay said mildly.
Oh, yes. The constable killer gun.
Edyard scratched the back of his head, wishing that part hadn't existed.
Yes, he conceded.
Could that mean repeat-fire guns?
Nanit said they talked with a foreign accent. Part of him wished it were true, that he could finally prove Ashwell's destruction had come at the hands of an unknown clan from somewhere else in the world.
But if that part of her story is genuine, he said immediately, then we really need to intercept the handover before these weapons get distributed to the ordinary gang members on the street. If they get their hands on them, we'll be facing a bloodbath.
Good point, Maxon said grudgingly.
They know we can conceal ourselves, Boyd said. I noticed a lot more dogs in Sampaloc when we were following up the Chariao thing. Most of the gang members have one these days.
I can protect us from a lot of bullets, Edyard said. And you know we can escape in ways they could never dream of.
The rest of the squad looked at each other.
Okay, Cancine said. But if these pistols are anything like Nanit claims, we're going to need some reliable backup.
I'll talk to Che and Ronak, Edyard said.
Two nights later, Edyard was wishing he had a little more confidence in the five squads of constables who were patrolling the Padua and Zelda districts. It was supposed to look like the patrols were purely random, following the whim of their corporals and sergeants. To anyone with a mistrustful mind, they were highly suspicious.
Or am I too paranoid?
Whatever. He and the squad had concealed themselves inside the base of a skewed tower in Erie, not too far from the Lady's Central Church. The tower next to them was supposed to be where the exchange would take place. Edyard didn't feel confident enough to wait there, no matter how good his concealment talent.
People were wending their way round the lofty twisted towers on their way to the huge church for the evening service. It was good cover for the gun exchange, he admitted, especially as the Pythia had refused to employ exclusion warrants for Eerie.
That's the third time, Cancine's directed Long Talk whispered. She gifted them the image of the G-Eagle that swooped silently round the tower outside. Then it darted in through a high, curving entrance and did a fast circuit of the huge, empty space inside. The tower chosen for the exchange was one of the tallest in Eerie, a monstrous, kinked spire whose jutting vertical ribs changed from smoky grey at the foot through a gentle amethyst to a sullen carmine at the top, where 8 tapering spikes curved up around the edges of its slanted platform. The open chamber at the bottom actually had 3 entrances, where most towers only had 1. Several lengthy stalagmites and stalactites of mauve-tinted crystal the interior, while at the center a broad, smooth shaft connected the black floor to the apex of the cave-like ceiling, 50 feet above. A single narrow opening led to the spiral stair which wound the entire height of the tower.
Get a load of this, Boyd said.
He'd sensed someone outside with a terrestrial dog on a lead. The dog was sniffing the ground as it was slowly walked around the tower.
Isn't that Paral? Maxon queried. He's got an exclusion warrant against him.
Whoever it was, the man with the dog walked away towards the bridge back to Fieka. A couple of constables in ordinary clothes sauntered casually after him. Orange light was beginning to shine out of cracks in the bark-like tower walls as the sun slid below the horizon. Another G-Eagle made a swift pass through the tower's chamber. Edyard kept his farsight focused on a gondola that had pulled up at a nearby mooring platform. 4 men with a strong seclusion haze stepped off it, carrying large iron-bound wooden chests between them. His farsight could just perceive the shadowy shapes of solid metal inside. Another gondola moored. The men on that one carried smaller boxes.
The ammunition, he muttered.
The church shut its wide doors as the evening service began. Bright orange light shone out of its roof dome and hundreds of windows along the 3 wings. A choir began to sing softly. Nearly a dozen people left wandering round outside began to make their way towards the tall tower.
Oh, great, Dinlay moaned.
One of the people stepping through the swathes of orange illumination cast by the towers was a very cocky Medath.
Edyard grinned unseen. He'll die of fright when we appear.
The men from the gondolas made their way into the tower, coming together to face Medath's group.
I make that 15 of them, Maxon said.
Edyard was trying to resolve the shapes inside the chests. They were definitely pistols, and not complex enough to be the repeat-fire types that had been used at Ashwell, thanked the lady.
Then he recognized them.
Okay, I've seen these pistols before. They're the ones Ivarl and his people used against me on the night of the fire. They have very large caliber bullets, but I can definitely ward them off.
Then we'd better stop them opening the chests, Boyd said.
Move out, Edyard said. As he hurried silently out of their hiding place and towards the tower ahead, he called Che. Move in now. There's 15 here, but they'll have watchers.
Already spotted 3, Che reassured him. We're coming.
Their deployment plan was simple enough. Dinlay and Boyd would take 1 tower entrance, Cancine and Maxon another, while Edyard would go in through the 3rd.
They're coming.
Edyard paused, frowning at the clear Long Talk. He couldn't tell where it had come from. It certainly wasn't any of the squad. Up ahead, the minds of the gang members were now radiating alarm. Their farsights scoured round. He strode up to the threshold, listening to the low anxious voices echoing off the mauve stalagmites and curious crannies in the chamber walls. The 2 groups were huddled together near the central shaft, with sentries positioned near each entrance.
Ready?
Cancine's Long Talk announced. The sentry nearest Edyard swung round, sending his farsight prying at the entrance Cancine was blocking. Edyard stepped into the tower and dropped his concealment, his shield hardened around his body. The sentry gasped in dismay.
Water walker!
He yelled with voice and mind. Edyard's 3rd hand reached out as he ran forward, yanking the 2 cases of pistols away from the gang members. They tried to prise them back but lacked the strength. Medath and his colleagues drew their own pistols.
Of course, Medath already had one of the long-barreled weapons. Ediard snarled in consternation. Two of the gang members started firing. Ediard dropped the cases on the ground outside the tower and concentrated on protecting himself. Men were running for the two open entrances. The first one to reach the opening covered by Khansine and Maxen yelled in shock as Khansine appeared abruptly, barely a yard in front of him. Her third hand punched directly against his temple, felling him instantly. She vanished. More shots were fired at the air she had occupied a second before. Ediard deflected a whole swarm of bullets, then people were playing chase around the stalagmites. "Stop this!" Ediard bellowed, his voice reverberating loudly round the chamber. "We know who you are. Several squads of constables are closing in. Our G-Eagles are flying outside. You cannot escape." A whole volley of bullets lashed at him. He shook his head in dismay. Dinlay rushed past, half visible as he pursued two men. Someone went sprawling, their inertia assisted by telekinesis, so their heads smacked into a stalagmite. Ediard snatched up two gang members and crashed them together. They fell limply onto the floor. Two more found themselves leaving the ground and screamed wildly. "Get up here!" It was the same long-talk voice as before, cutting cleanly through the shouts and mental babble inside the chamber. Ediard looked round zealously, trying to see who it was. His farsight caught Medath rushing into the opening at the foot of the central pillar. Four of the gang were now standing together, their hands held high in surrender, pistols abandoned at their feet. Boyd appeared directly in front of them, his pistol raised, ready. More pistol shots echoed round the chamber. Then there was a pain-racked howl, overriding all the other voices. Maxen flicked into visibility behind a man who was clutching at his shoulder. Blood poured through his fingers. Maxen pulled his pistol away from the wound. "Next time it will be a headshot," he announced loudly. "Now stop this, you are under arrest." He vanished again. Ediard raced over to the central pillar. On the way, his third hand picked up three gang members, who immediately stopped struggling. He dropped them beside Dinlay. The sound of footsteps reverberated out of the pillar's opening. When Ediard looked inside, he saw the spiral stairs winding upwards. "Oh, come on!" he yelled up at Medath. "There's nowhere to go." But who told him to go up there? Could they really see through our concealment? With a growl of anger, he started running up the steps. Almost immediately, he slipped on a cumbersome curve, banging his knee badly. The burst of pain was enough to stretch a mist of red sparkles across his vision. Medath's footsteps were becoming fainter as Ediard scrambled upright again. "If that's how you want to do it," he muttered, and set off again. "Ediard?" Kansine's voice echoed up the stairs. "Medath went up here. I'll get him. You hang on down there." The pillar walls were incredibly thick, restricting his farsight more than he liked. He could just make out the constable squad swarming towards the tower. In the chamber below, his squadmates surrounded the defeated gang members. Above him there was a moving glimmer which he knew was Medath's mind. Round and round the pair of them went. A tiny thread of orange light twinkled out of the narrow vault of the roof above Ediard, just enough to illuminate the horrible curving stairs. He had to stretch his legs at each semi-jump upwards. How Medath kept up such a pace was beyond understanding. Ediard's heart was hammering loudly, while he could feel his lungs burning inside his chest. Sweat was pouring down his back and legs. When he was two-thirds of the way up, he simply had to slow, which only increased his anger. Medath started to pull ahead. By the time Ediard reached the last spiral, he was practically walking. Each breath had to be hauled down into his lungs with a big heave of his chest. Hair was glued against his forehead by sweat. Concentration was difficult. Nonetheless, he managed to send his farsight out onto the circular platform which topped the tower. The eight spikes that rose from the edge stabbed up into the sky, their slightly crooked tips peaking at another 40 feet above the platform floor. Medath was out there, standing 10 feet in front of the central cone where the stair exited. He was already aiming the pistol at the opening, waiting for Ediard to emerge.
"Oh, lady,"
Ediard wheezed in dismay. The anger which had carried him so far was now diluted by fatigue.
"I should have just waited at the bottom.
Hunger would bring him down eventually. He started up the last few steps. It would be easy enough to deal with Medath. But then Medath would know that, and I still don't know who that long talker was, or where they are. As if to reinforce his concern, a clammy feeling of trepidation began to manifest. It was so strong he had to pause again. Something was badly wrong. He knew that without knowing why. He took a more cautious step upwards and began a thorough survey of the platform. He froze. Medath wasn't alone out there on the platform. The floor was feeling the weight of four more pairs of feet, yet Edyard's farsight could find nothing.
Nanit! He spat as his anger rose again. Oh, crap. Maxon will never let this one drop.
When he was almost up to the exit, Edyard concealed himself again and asked the city to let him through the wall. He emerged out onto the platform 5 feet to the side of the exit. The first thing which surprised him was the wind. Down on the ground it was perfectly calm. Up here it pushed against him. He leaned into it. His four concealed foes were standing together over by one of the spikes. Edyard could see nothing against the pale wash of nebula light that shimmered across the heavens above Macathran. As quietly as he could, he made his way over to them. He passed within a couple of yards of Medath, who was still staring at the stair exit, his long-barreled pistol held steady. Once Edyard was past the comically alert gangman, he realized the platform floor actually slanted down towards the edge. A tinge of what must be vertigo produced a shiver along his legs. He refused to let it get the better of him, and crept forwards. The feet began to shift. At first, the two foes at the front took a step backwards. Then they all began to move closer to the spike. Edyard grinned savagely and carried on after them. He was only 5 yards away when something struck him with colossal force, impacting on his left side, just below the bottom of his ribcage. Edyard cried out, as much from surprise as pain. His concealment faltered as he fought for breath. Medath swung round. Another blow slammed into Edyard, knocking him to the floor.
"Shoot him," a long talk whisper ordered.
"How did they see me?" Medath fired. The bullet almost got through Edyard's shield. A powerful telekinetic shove sent him skidding down the slight incline. He had a terrible flashback to the day by Birmingham Pool when Armanel had pushed him over the edge.
"Lady, help!" "Again!"
The bullet struck him, as did a further telekinetic blow. Edyard was shunted over the edge of the platform. His arms flailed wildly, but straining fingers missed anything solid.
"Can you fly, Water Walker?"
Edyard plummeted downwards, screaming all the way. He instinctively tried to grip the tower with his third hand. He could even feel the force lock into the grainy structure of the wall. It didn't stop his descent. His thoughts arrowed down to the city's slumbering mind as the air roared around him.
"Can you help?"
he pleaded to the slow giant thoughts. It was useless. He was falling. Falling.
"Christabel?"
Somewhere on the edge of perception he heard her scream wildly. He directed one last thought.
"I love you."
Content, she would know. It made death more bearable. Falling. Beneath him a vivid wave of alarm gushed from the minds of the constables scurrying round the base of the tower. Falling. Any second now. He braced himself for the terrible burst of pain which would strike for an instant before death. Falling.
"How the lady fuck are you doing that?"
Che's dazed voice asked. Something slapped Edyard's ass. It was the ground.
"Huh?"
Edyard grunted dumbly. He looked up to see a circle of about 10 faces peering down at him, all of them wearing utterly incredulous expressions. His hands patted the ground in disbelief. He was down, intact.
"I fell,"
he blurted. But of course, it always felt like he was falling when the city lowered him down to its tunnels. It must be the same out here. There was a near-hysterical laugh threatening to bubble out of his throat. Tears were already leaking from his eyes as the shock kicked in. Some of the constables staring down were shoved aside. Cansine and Boyd lunged into the gaps.
"Edyard!" Cansine squealed. "Oh, lady, what happened?"
"Trap," he said weakly. He pointed up at the dark shape of the tower looming above them. surprised by how much effort it was just to raise his arm.
"Medath?"
she asked in surprise. Edyard nodded. It was hard to breathe. His body was tingling everywhere, and now he was starting to shake. His farsight could just discern a pulse of animal terror from somewhere. It was growing fast.
"What's happening?"
he rasped. "What?"
"Edyard?"
Boyd was sounding very faint. Che was frowning, glancing round. Edyard didn't have the strength to speak.
"Can you sense that?"
he long talked.
"What?"
Kansine asked. Then Che was broadcasting pure alarm.
"Move!"
The old sergeant pushed at Kansine with his third arm. At the same time, he tried to jump backwards. Edyard saw it then, directly above him. A black human silhouette against the green glowing beauty of the Ku Nebula. Edyard tried to roll away. What was left of his telekinetic strength roused feebly to ward off the plunging body. Medath hit the ground, 2 feet away from where Edyard was lying. Che was only half clear. The collision produced a vile crunch as a multitude of bones snapped. Edyard stared vacantly at the tangle of broken flesh beside him. Blood dribbled out of Che's slack, open mouth. The sergeant's eyes moved very slowly to meet Edyard's gaze. Far away, someone was wailing. It sounded like Kansine.
"Sergeant?"
Edyard asked.
"Oh, by the lady,"
Che long talked.
"For a moment there, that really hurt."
"No,"
Edyard said.
"Oh, no."
Che let out his final rattling breath. Edyard tried to hang on to the man's mind, his farsight following the thoughts as they diminished. As they dwindled towards their extinction, they disconnected from the body. Edyard perceived the spectral shape of Che rising up to stand over his own corpse.
"Sergeant,"
Edyard sent in desperation.
"Oh, my lady,"
the spectre sent back.
"Sergeant!" "Edyard!"
It was Dinley, kneeling beside him, frightened, shouting.
"Can you see him?"
Edyard whispered.
"Edyard, you're going into shock. Try and focus on me." "This isn't shock."
Edyard gifted them his perception. There was a collective intake of breath as the constables gathered round saw their sergeant's spirit smiling gently.
"I can feel it, Edyard,"
Che explained. He was looking up, searching the heavens.
"So beautiful. They're calling to me. The nebulas are singing. Can you hear them?" "No,"
Edyard wept.
"No, I can't."
A gaggle of mothers from the central church were arriving to investigate the furor, their anxious voices stilled as they received the gift of Edyard's perception. Then the Pythia herself was standing next to Che's broken body, an expression of serene joy on her face. One hand reached out tentatively, trying to touch his spirit.
"I want to go,"
Che told his enraptured audience.
"I have to. There's nothing left for me here."
"You'll be lost up there,"
Edyard told him.
"Stay with us. Stay until the Sky Lords return to guide you."
"The songs, Edyard. Ah, the songs. What a welcome awaits us. Wait, please."
Che smiled down. It was as though he was giving a blessing.
"Don't worry about me. I'll follow the songs."
"May the lady bring you safe to the heart," the Pythia said.
"Thank you, dear mother,"
Che replied. He reached up to the sky as if it were a physical thing he could hold and own. His shape began to waver. As he looked down for the last time, the slightest frown appeared on his phantom features.
"Who are you?"
Then his outline swirled away with astonishing speed as it rose towards the nebulas he sought. Edyard fell back with a last sob. Darkness claimed him. Consciousness returned with a slow flush of warmth. Edyard felt perfectly content lying wherever he was, with his eyes closed and his mind at rest. He was breathing normally, not particularly hungry. A light sheet lay across him. What more could anyone ask?
"Christabel," he said, knowing she was there. He didn't use farsight, he just knew.
"You're awake.
Her fingers stroked his face. He opened his eyes to see her smiling down at him. It was the most wonderful sight.
"Don't you ever do that again," she chided.
"I won't." She kissed him.
"People have been worried," she said.
"I'll bet." Edyard looked round. He was in some grand room, high ceilings, walls covered in tapestries and oil paintings. Familiar wood-framed glass doors opened onto a hortus. Bright sunlight shone through.
"Is it midday already?" Edyard, you fell 2 days ago."
"Oh."
"Our doctor said you were suffering a combination of exhaustion and shock. She gave you something to keep you asleep. She said you needed time to recover."
Edyard pulled a face as he licked his tongue round inside his mouth. Something tasted bad.
Christabel handed him a tall glass of water.
"Thanks."
He lifted himself up gingerly as she pushed some pillows behind his back to support him.
"You're the talk of Macathran. Again," she told him with a sly grin. Edyard gave a feeble shrug.
"I thought you were going to die when you called me."
Her eyes began to fill with tears.
"I'm sorry."
He reached for her, holding her close for a long time. When she'd calmed, she said,
"And now you can fly, too."
"I can't, actually. That's something else altogether. The city, Christabel. It helps me."
"The city? You mean Macathran?"
"Yes." He could sense the puzzlement in her mind.
"I'll try and explain. It's quite complicated. Perhaps I should explain to everyone. I don't know."
She rested her hand on his chest.
"You just wait. There's an awful lot you need to say to a great many people. But you need to be very careful exactly what you tell them. And you're not in any condition to make those decisions right now."
"Okay." He knew she was right about that.
"You also saw poor Sergeant Che's soul. If you thought you were famous before, you won't believe what you are now."
"I thought I hallucinated that part."
"Thanks to your gifting, the Pythia herself spoke with his soul as it departed. You don't get a more believable witness than that. She's been waiting to talk to you about what she's calling your lady-blessed connection to the spirit world. We're to inform her immediately you're recovered," Christabel said significantly.
Edyard instinctively gripped the sheet tighter, drawing it up a couple of inches. He was only wearing a baggy nightshirt underneath.
"So who undressed me?"
Christabel gave him a lofty glance. "I sent my maids in to prepare you for your rest."
"What?"
She burst into giggles. "The doctor and the novices attended you."
"Oh."
Not that it made the idea much more tolerable.
"Novices."
Christabel hugged him. "Thank the lady you're still my silly Edyard." "What about my friends?"
"Waiting outside, very impatiently, causing a lot of trouble for the staff. And they're all fine. Before you ask, the gang members are under arrest and awaiting trial in the cells under Parliament House. Their constable killer guns were recovered, and you'll never guess where they came from."
"Where?" he asked eagerly.
"The Weapons Guild."
"No."
"Yes. Apparently they're a secret type the guild holds safe, in case the city is ever attacked. The design dates back centuries. Owen is furious. He's ordered a full inquiry into how they were taken out of storage. Nobody was supposed to know about them apart from the guild's most senior masters."
"That's got to be damaging to Owen in council."
"I expect so. Daddy was really cheerful when he told me."
"Thank you," he said softly. She gave him a breezy smile.
"What for?"
"Being here."
"You're welcome, Water Walker."
She kissed him again. A more sultry embrace this time, containing a great deal of promise.
"I'll call them in. I know you want to see them. Don't worry, the doctor already instructed them to be quick and not to stress you."
They came in as one group, Cansine anxious until she actually saw him awake and sitting up in bed. Then she became quite emotional. Boyd, nervous, almost shy. Dinley, boyishly eager, holding a big basket of sugared fruits. Maxon, however, had a huge grin on his face.
"Nanit," he whooped gleefully, finger jabbing at Edyard for emphasis. "I told you so."